Welcome to Summit University Forum, where the flame of freedom speaks. Today our guest is Tony Sutton, author, lecturer, and the one, if you'll remember, who exposed to the American people that conspiracy to supply the Soviet Union with technology and funds. His books on Western technology and Soviet economic development, National Suicide, The War on Gold, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and Wall Street and FDR, give a very detailed analysis and accounting from documents of our own government, private sources, and private research, showing absolutely and finally and factually that the United States and the Western democracies have supplied and built the Soviet Union, its military complex, and sustained it economically. Today, our friend Tony is here with us, with Murray Steinman, teacher of 20th Century Studies at Montessori International High School. We're here to discuss what is going to be Tony's great work, his essays and research on the order. Tony, welcome to Summit University Forum. Today you are the flame of freedom that speaks. Please tell us about the order and how you came to discover it exists.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. The order is truly a secret society. It was founded in the United States at Yale University in 1833. It has continued and exists down to the present day. Each year, the order takes in 15 men, senior students from Yale University. Never more than 15. Only once has it been less than 15. In 1946, they took in, I think, 10 rather than 15 members. So what we have is a secret society which, over the last 150 years, has accumulated about 2,500 members, of whom perhaps 500 are alive today. Of this 500, perhaps 100 are actively in pursuit of the objectives of the order. It's not another college fraternal society. Yale University is the only university in the United States, or indeed the world, which has senior societies. These are societies where the 15 are selected in the junior year and actually are initiated at the beginning of the senior year. They stay on campus only 1 year as members. They are called knights. When they graduate, they leave the university, they go out into the world, then they're known as patriarchs. So at any one time, you only have 15 knights in existence, and for the rest of their lives, they're known as patriarchs. And they work during their lifetime, or a number do, towards the ends of the order. They are pretty much guaranteed success. Certainly they're guaranteed financial success. And in my reading of the material I have, I infer that so long as they go along with the purposes of the order, so long as they gear their careers and their lives towards certain ends, then they are guaranteed success. How did I come to this knowledge? Well, up to 6 months ago, I denied that there was a conspiracy, because, frankly, I couldn't prove one. I suspected a conspiracy, but I couldn't prove there was one until 6 months ago. Well, a little before 6 months ago, I received the catalog, which is the membership list of the society, all the way back to 1833, and I received some of their internal documents, enough for me to put together the way they correspond with each other, the operations within the order, to some extent their problems, and to some extent their objectives.
Now, this is the book, An Introduction to the Order, by Anthony C. Sutton. It has a skull and bones on the front and 322.
The 322 is an identification. The order has a temple on the Yale campus. A temple, yes. It's a building maybe this 50, 60 feet by 40 feet, maybe 40 feet high. There's no windows, two big steel doors. We know what the temple looks like because back in 1880s, a number of Yale students became a little unhappy about what was going on inside this temple. When they went by it at midnight, sometimes they heard strange noises and all kinds of rumors on the Yale campus as to what this might be. There was a break-in. I call it the Yale Gate. there was a break-in to the temple, and the students who broke in cataloged what they found, and they made a drawing, a design of the interior of the temple. And three of the rooms are numbered. One is 322, one is 323, and one is 324. 322 is also, I suspect, the chapter number. And also in correspondence between members, they conclude their correspondence, where you and I would conclude yours truly or yours sincerely, they conclude yours in 322. Why 322? There are several theories for this. One is that the order originated with Demosthenes, the Greek, in 322 BC. That's one theory. Another one is that it stems from the founding date in the United States, which was 1832. So really we have the last two numbers, 32, the second chapter of founded in 1832. We also know that, so far as the order is concerned, we are presently in Period 1. Period 1 began in 1801. I don't know when it ends. I don't know when Period 3 will begin. Period 1 logically must be sometime before 1801. The skull and crossbones are prominent in their ceremonies, initiation ceremonies.
This is a symbol of death. Now, why would they take a symbol of death?
Yes. From what I understand, when a new member is initiated, that would be in the senior year at Yale, he's placed within a coffin.
Oh, my.
And now, we only know this from the Yale Gate papers. At least I call it Yale Gate. And from the photographs we have of members inside the temple, many of these photographs are the 15 sitting around a table, and they have the skull and the crossbones sitting on the table in front of them. It is the symbol of death, and it has been called the Brotherhood of Death, and I think it probably more adequately should be called the Brotherhood of Death.
Why? What do they do?
Well, the way I've had to go about it is organizations like this don't print manifestos. They don't publish manifestos or operation schedules. So what I've had to do is look at the history, the biographies of the leading members of the order, and reconstruct their career and see if there's a common pattern in their careers. While doing that, I came across some interesting documents. Some members apparently are not too happy once they become involved with this after 10 or 20 years. One member in particular left a memorandum. He wrote it in 1932. It was buried away in his papers. I don't think anybody found it before I did. And it was a 6-page memorandum on the order, naming some of the members, and said it was the most sordid thing ever happened in the history of man. So, but to come back to my point, I have to reconstruct the objectives. What are the objectives? In the words of one member, might is right. If you have the power, you use it to achieve your objectives. What is the objective? As you look at the histories of individual members, it can only be one thing: to acquire power, to keep power, to use power for their own purposes.
Tony, who are some of the key members of the order, and how are these people selected?
They are selected by the what they call the next previous class. In other words, if you were to be initiated this year, next year would be your first year as a patriarch. That senior year, selects the next group from the junior class. Within the order, each group of 15, are known as clubs. I call them cells because they're very close to the Jacobin cell, the revolutionary cells, but internally they refer them as clubs. Each club has an identifying number. For example, Avril Harriman is a very influential member of the order, the son of Edward Harriman, the railroad magnate. Harriman was initiated in 1913. His club number is D111. All the other 14 of D111 have died off. Avril Harriman is the only one left. To come to the other part of your question, who are some of the significant members? Today, two men stand out. One is Avril Harriman, who is the chief financial angel of the Democratic Party. The other is Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush. The Bush family is quite prominent within the order. Now, if you go back in history a little, you'll find that George Bush's father, Prescott Sheldon Bush, was also a member of the order. He was a member of Brown Brothers Harriman, which is the Harriman Private Banking Company. So today you've got two men who are supposedly in politics in opposition, Bush and Harriman. Actually, they're members of the same secret society, and Bush's father was not only a member, he was a partner in the what was then Harriman & Company, which later became Brown Brothers Harriman. So behind the scenes, and this is something you don't see until you investigate it, people who appear to be in opposition politically or financially or industrially or in many ways are working together. Other members might be William Buckley. Now, William Buckley became a member in 1949, but the preceding class to that was Bush, 1948. So you get Bush was amongst the 15 who selected Buckley. And Buckley's club, that 15, was the 15 that selected, for example, one of the new members for 50 was the Reverend Sloan Coffin, Jr. The Reverend Sloan Coffin, Jr. at Yale was at the core of the anti-Vietnamese war disturbances on Yale campus. This is typical. You'll find that men in the same society will take opposite positions in public. So you've got William Buckley, whom I call a House conservative as a member, but so is a man, for example, called Edwin Burt, who has a string of communist affiliations, which is about that long. And we'll get into this later. The method they use is that of the Hegelian dialectic. Thesis played against antithesis leads to a synthesis. In other words, for Hegel, for history to make progress, you have to have conflict. And when you look at the key people in the order, you will find that they generate conflict. So Bush and Harriman politically are conflicting. Coffin and Buckley, although part of the same order, are in public conflicting with one another because conflict leads to the new synthesis. Other prominent members, one of the most prominent was Howard William Taft, the only man to be both president and chief justice of the United States. The Taft family founded the order in the United States. There have been eight Taft family members within the order. Taft was probably the most prominent member around the turn of the century, 1910, 1920. Stimson, who was Secretary of War under Taft, then Secretary of State under Hoover, Secretary of War under Roosevelt. In other words, at that level, politics disappears, and people often wonder why does a Democrat join a Republican administration. If you check back, you find often it's not as a member of the order. So key people would be people like Taft, Stimson, Archibald MacLeish, who wrote the Constitution for UNESCO, also Librarian of Congress, the Bush family, the Walker family, and above all today, if there's a godfather in the order, it's Avril Harriman.
Well, Tony, here we have an elected representative in our government who could become the occupant of the highest office in the land, who, unbeknownst to those who have elected him, belongs to a secret society with purposes and goals antithetical to those of the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, exactly what causes does the order espouse, and why are these divergent to those of our founding fathers?
Well, the causes one can only deduce at this point from the operations of these men as individuals and working together. They want to acquire power above all.
Power?
Political
to do what?
Power. As you look at their actions, the political power is to bring about what they call a new world order, which is a one world. But they use the Hegelian techniques, and we know enough about Hegel to know that not only does this mean the dialectic process, the creation of conflict, but it also means that individuals such as you and I, or anybody watching this program, will be cogs in the state, that we have no individual rights. Individual rights for Hegel come about through obedience to the state. We see it in the educational process, which we'll probably talk about later, that we have adopted what I call a Hegelian system of education, which is not to bring out your innate talents, but to prepare you to be an individual cog in the state.
Now, are you saying the members of the order believe this, and this is a part of their worldview?
I would say that there is a minority within the order that does believe it. There's one thing I've learned in looking at the papers, that they're not all active. Maybe at any one time only 20% are active. Undoubtedly, the 20% that are active have this goal. If you look at Taft, Taft's great work, although as a president he hasn't accounted for very much in the literature, Taft's great work was to bring about the world court, international law. International law and a world court will be essential in a new world order. If you take, for example, the career of Bush, Vice President Bush, when he was ambassador to the United Nations, he helped a process called Mundialization, which was a process by which an individual American city would adopt United Nations stature. In other words, it's a diminution, a dilution of U.S. sovereignty. So if you look at these individuals, Stimson is another very good example. Avril Harriman, certainly, in the way he's financed the Soviet Union, his work towards the build-up of the Soviet Union. If you look at these individuals and ask what is the common pattern is the creation of a one world.
Now, supposedly, these people believe that they are great benefactors of our society, the wise men, those who are especially endowed to rule, and who also believe that the best interests of America happen to be their own best interests as well.
I have never seen anything in their literature which leads me to believe that they have our individual rights in their hearts. What I do see in the literature and in the documents is a ruthless drive to acquire power for themselves and to help each other, because this is one of the tenets of the order, that if you have three men coming before you for a job, the preference absolutely goes to your brother in the order. This is in my book, The Order, Introduction to the Order, I call these the chains of influence, and I trace one pattern where Stimson brought the McBundy family into the War Department. Then the McBundys go on and become key people both in Department of Defense and in the Council on Foreign Relations. They help each other along the way. And when you get even a small number of men doing this, it can exert a very powerful force, a very powerful influence.
So the basic assumption is that because they know what is best for America, the way to preserve that is to amass power to see to it that the destiny they envision comes to pass.
My assessment is they're not thinking what is best for America, they're thinking what is best for the order.
What is best for the order
comes first.
Is what is best for America
in their eyes. Yes, in their eyes.
And what's good for us has to be good for America, so we will remold America according to
their pattern.
That's right.
Yes.
But somehow there's a twinge of a sense that we are right and we know better than the common people, where we have a better sense of the way this nation should go, and this is the justification for the whole secrecy and the order, because we really are doing what is best for the country.
It's very interesting you should say that, because amongst the documents I have are some correspondence between members, and I have letters in which one member complains to another that along the lines that elitism is not accepted. It's an egalitarian society. They're complaining even on the Yale campus they're no longer accepted. In other words, they are worried.
They're not recognized to be superior any longer.
Yes, the people are beginning to criticize elites, that we don't accept elites as they perhaps were accepted at one time. And this is a definite worry within the order. It's not a monolithic situation where they hold all power. They have their worries. They have their concerns about us, that we won't accept them. And this comes out quite clearly in some of their literature. They are concerned that American society is no longer elitist, it is egalitarian.
Well, they are realizing that the American people, being educated these 200 years, are beginning to discover that there are individuals who set themselves apart to rule and do not always do so in the best interests of the little people.
Yes, and of course their concern is that this elitism is not accepted, that they have critics.
Tony, people who have looked at the One World Government have pointed to the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations and other organizations like this, but they've ignored the order. No one's really talked about it before you have. How has it remained secret for this long?
It remains secret for 150 years because these people are under an oath not to talk about it. I understand that a member of the order may not remain in the room if it comes under discussion. Now, if I can elaborate on this a little bit, this poses a problem for Mr. Bush, because I write something called the Phoenix Letter, which is a monthly newsletter, and last November I began to open up. And a reader wrote to Mr. Bush and said, is what Mr. Sutton says, are you a member of this order? And the letter the reader got back was very interesting. It said, in effect, that the vice president was not a member of a sordid secret society. That was not the question. The question was, are you a member of a secret society? The answer came back, he is not a member of a sordid secret society. Inserted the word, you see. This was a reader who doesn't give up, so he went back again. And I understand that, as it stands, as we are now, that Mr. Bush is not willing either to admit he is a member of the order or to deny it, because they're under this oath not to discuss it.
So when people look at the Council on Foreign Relations, in effect what they've been doing is looking at a kind of a veil which hides the order?
Yes. The core, or my work, came about almost by accident. If someone had not donated to me the membership list, we wouldn't be here today. It's remained secret because nobody has done that. Everybody's been looking at the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers. They are not truly conspiracies because the membership lists are open. The membership list of the order has not been open. So there's a distinction between the CFR and the Trilaterals and the order. CFR and Trilaterals are not conspiracies because they are not secret.
Well, you know, Tony, they have very powerful men in both of these organizations.
Oh, yes.
David Rockefeller, David Packard, who I know you know well. How does the order direct or control people who have such wealth and such influence?
It has members of the order in extraordinarily most of your key spots in the United States, in manufacturing, in business, in law, in finance, in banking, you name it, there's a member there. In many areas, it only needs one man on a committee to say no. For example, I've identified so far a dozen publishing houses with one member of the order on the board of directors. All that man has to do is say no, and the manuscript doesn't get published. So one way they influence is by one man's negative vote, often on a committee. If a man will persistently say no, he wins the day. Another way they do it is by social persuasion. It's the country club technique. You'll get two members who are thinking along the same lines. They'll meet the David Rockefeller or the David Packards or whatever in the country club. They will both give him the same argument and put pressure on him. So you've got this social persuasion aspect. You can't document it. You can't identify it. But obviously, it's at work here. You've got other organizations, particularly the private banks. For example, Brown Brothers Harriman, very important private bankers. I've identified 9 members of the order in this one banking organization. This probably is the core of the order in the United States, Brown Brothers Harriman, the bankers. So there, you've got nine of them sitting down together, and you know they're working together for financial purposes. So they control and they influence and they dominate in a number of different ways.
So would, let's say, Bill Buckley and Mr. Harriman sit down, do they say, let's figure out how we can use a little right-left pressure to move the country in such and such a direction?
I wouldn't. They wouldn't have to do that. If Averill and Bill Buckley ever sit down, and I'm sure they do, they sit down as brothers in the order, which makes them different from you and I right away. They've gone through the same initiation ceremonies. They know their history. They know what they've achieved. They know what they want to achieve. They sit down as brothers of the order. They don't have to discuss really ways to do things. It's perhaps a little difficult to explain, but they don't map out strategies. They don't have to.
They are the strategy.
They are the strategy, exactly.
So they do what comes naturally.
They do what comes naturally. And this, of course, is very different to the argument to many people who have promoted conspiracy have made. They get across the idea that these people telephone each other and have little drawings and maps and diagrams. They don't operate like that at all. If you meet these people, they think alike. They talk alike. They come up with the same ideas simultaneously, and they move simultaneously. They know what they have to do.
So they're a breed.
They're a breed. Exactly.
Now, Tony, what has this breed done? What are their chief accomplishments in molding domestic and foreign policy and actual events in American history since their founding at Yale?
One is they have acquired enormous political and financial power. You'll find representatives of the order in politics. As
what
I
have
mentioned.
They done with this power? What has happened to America that would not have happened had they not been the order?
Creation of war and revolution.
Specifically, which ones? Do you have documents
The third book in this series, which I'm bringing out, takes two wars and one revolution. Well, two revolutions and one war. World War II, the Bolshevik Revolution, and the rise of Hitler, which I call a revolution in Germany. We can find the order behind the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. We can find the behind the rise of Hitler. We can find the behind. We can find the in the maintenance of both of these systems, the transfer of technology to both.
Since you've already proven that Wall Street is behind the Bolshevik Revolution and the rise of Hitler, now you're proving that the order is behind Wall Street.
Exactly.
Now, who's the key figure in the order or figures that mold Wall Street?
In order of dominance, Averill Harriman, partner in Brown Brothers Harriman. Stanley of Morgan Stanley. It used to be J.P. Morgan, then it became Morgan Stanley. Those two are the key.
Now, what did the order want to accomplish in the Bolshevik Revolution?
You create opposing forces which you place in conflict. Out of conflict, you've got profit, you've got political power, and you can direct history. And if you look at the writings, for example, of the Trilateral Commission, they talk openly in the Trilateral Commission about managing conflicts. Not solving conflicts, but managing conflicts. Conflict management, that's the cry.
So they got the profit, the power, and the management.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they want to steer history through the Bolshevik Revolution?
They wanted to set up, and they did, two opposing forces, the Soviet Union and Hitler's Germany. Out of that came World War II. There were logical steps in the process. They used the same bank, Guaranteed Trust Company, as the conduit for the financing of Hitler, and also as a conduit for financing, and also the early days of the Russian Revolution. In fact, in Russia, Soviet Russia in 1923, a vice president of Guaranteed Trust Company was the foreign director of the Roscombank, which was the first Soviet overseas bank that was set up. They were that close in those days. You'll get a very close relationship between the early Hitler days and members of the order, which is in the third book I'm bringing up.
Why did the order and then Wall Street want to finance Hitler? What was their goal?
Because you've got to have two opposing sides.
All right. Out of these two opposing sides, what was the synthesis
was
that they intended?
World War II.
All right. Then what did they want to accomplish with World War II?
Conflict, and out of conflict, you got political power, out of which they created United Nations.
Well, surely they want to accomplish something with the power they acquire, a specific social goal, management of the population, and then, of course, you get into education.
Well, I think out of World War II, you got many organizations I see World War II as a step on the road to establishment of a world order. Because out of World War II, you got United Nations. You got this whole complex of so-called international organizations. You got the beginnings of a world economy. And you get, certainly in education and communications, the beginning of a world communication system. So World War II is a step in the road to a world society. But the old dialectic of Soviet Russia and Hitler's Germany wouldn't work any longer because Hitler's Germany, of course, was no longer there after World War II, so they set up a new dialectic. In the 50s and the 60s, it was the United States and the Soviet Union. That became a little dangerous, and they recognized it by the early 70s. So the new dialectic, which you will see in the 80s and the 90s, is the Soviet Union on the one hand, and of course, Communist China on the other. Out of this, notice they're transferring military technology to both. And by 1990, or the year 2000, you will get Soviet Union and Communist China in a conflict mode. And out of that conflict, they can take us another step towards world order.
When you have world order, then the order has world power.
Exactly.
And since, as you say, the state is a myth, the power really is in the hands of the order.
Exactly.
So the goal is power.
The goal is power from beginning to end.
Stay in control to be sure the masses of the people don't rise up and begin to determine their own fate and destiny.
And the way they achieve power is absolutely immoral. As one member said, this was Sumner, said, might is right, which was Hitler's argument. Might is right. If you have the power, you have the right to use it. It goes back to Hegel.
As the inversion of Camelot.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Why don't you tell us exactly how they've moved in for control of the common people through the control of education? Do you want to tell us about that triumvirate of Dwight and White and Gilman?
Well, there were three men back in the 19th century, three members of the order, whom I identified as being at the very beginning of our modern educational system. One was Gilman. He was the key man. Another was Dwight, who later became president of Yale University. And the other is White, who became president of Cornell University. The key man is Gilman. Gilman was a member of the order. He, in 1856, he established the Russell Trust. Within the order, they call it the RTA in their correspondence. RTA, for short, was the legal entity which is the financial vehicle for the order. And then Gilman, White, and Dwight all went to Germany. And in the 1850s, the 1860s, there were graduate students in Germany. And that was the time of when Hegel, the philosopher Hegel, was very prominent in Germany. And I have some of their early letters in which you could see that they've picked up the philosophy of Hegel, which is the complete antithesis of what we understand, certainly in the United States and England. For Hegel, the individual is subordinate to the state. This is what they picked up. This is what they brought back. When Gilman came back, he first became president of the University of California. He didn't last too long because a man called Henry George was then editor of a San Francisco newspaper. Henry George, a socialist in quotes. Henry George was an unusual man. He was against monopoly. They call him a socialist, but he was anti-monopolist. Henry George spotted Gilman. He didn't like him. He wrote scathing editorials. In the end, Gilman wrote a letter to Dwight, I think it was, and said, I'm going to have to leave here before the roof falls in. So they found him a job as president of Johns Hopkins University. At Johns Hopkins, he began the process which ended up in control of the modern educational system. He brought in a psychologist, G. Stanley Hall, who had been trained under Wilhelm Wundt in Germany, the founder of experimental psychology. Hall began the process which ended up, by the way, John Dewey did his doctorate at Johns Hopkins under Gilman and under Stanley Hall, came out of their influence. But John Dewey, who is the core of modern education, was already a Hegelian in thinking. These people just put a rubber stamp on it. And then came a process which you see time and time again. A man who is not a member of the order, but whose direction in life is towards their goals is helped along. And you can see this in the careers of Hall and Dewey, who were really quite inconsequential men. But they were pushed and promoted and pushed and promoted. And Hall certainly never knew why he had such a successful career. He didn't know that behind the scenes, when he needed money, the money was there. When he needed another job was there. And that's what happens with the people of use to the order. Anyway, to come back to Gilman, Gilman made sure that Hall bought Wundtian and Experimental Psychology in the United States. This, through John Dewey, ended up in the Lincoln School, the experimental schools, the experimental educational laboratories at Columbia University and at University of Chicago, funded by Rockefeller money. Also in one of my books, I have identified, I think, 500 or 600 doctorates which were awarded by this very small group out of Johns Hopkins. So within about 20 years, these people had awarded doctorates to hundreds of people identified as those already thinking along these lines. So anyone who's an individualist or tends to be a man alone or who doesn't believe in political power, the use of power for immoral purposes, got shunted to one side. So I can understand why many people, and I've met them over the years, wondered why they never received a doctorate. Well, I can give you one answer, is that they weren't thinking the right way to get a doctorate to appeal to a certain committee. So anyway, out of this came our whole Dewey system of education, and if you look at John Dewey, you will see. John Dewey says what Hegel says, that the function of education is not to bring out your innate talents, not to see what you're good at and help you along. It's not to educate you, not to teach you to read or to do arithmetic. That's not the purpose of education at all. And John Dewey is quite clear if you read him, and so was Hegel. The whole function of education is to prepare you to be a part of the state apparatus, is to prepare you to be a useful little cog in the workings of the state.
So it's Orwellian.
It's Orwellian, but it's Hegel. You find freedom in obedience to the state, which is upside down to us. But
so here we are in 1984, and parents and educators in America alike are in an uproar over the low scores of our high school students. And you've written another manifesto on the order, How the Order Controls Education. Now, in this one, you expose this little triumvirate and the evolution of the control of education, and you point out their introduction of the look-say method later on, and how this was originally for deaf mutes.
Yes, the look-say method of reading, in which I wasn't brought up that way, thank goodness, but apparently you look at a word and you're supposed to be able to recognize the word from just by looking at it without breaking it down into
it's like Chinese hieroglyphs,
letters.
You have to memorize a thousand.
Well, that was originally developed in 1818 by Golladay for deaf and dumb people. Works fine for deaf and dumb people. And very ingenious and a very useful invention if you're deaf and dumb. I can see that. But then apparently someone in the order recognized its usefulness because two Golladays, the grandsons of the original Golladay, were inducted into the order. You'll find two Golladays in the order, grandsons of the original inventor of this. And you get Horace Mann comes along in 1840, and through Antioch College, which was controlled by the order, the Taft at that time. This is how I say people who are not in the order but are useful to it get pushed along. Horace Mann was useful to the order, was brought into Antioch and pushed along in his career.
Listen,
Horace Mann picked up Look-Say, and Look-Say came through John Dewey, and that's what we have today. You wonder why the kids can't read. Of course they can't read.
To laugh, Tony, because I went to Antioch.
Oh, excuse me. Well, you know about the trustees with Taft.
Oh, I know a lot about Antioch, and I know how it felt to be there. But
well, I didn't know.
It prides itself in being very liberal, very free, and very individualistic.
Well, liberal in quotes, because if you look at these systems, they are anti-liberal in the sense that I understand it 100 years ago. They're not liberal in the sense of freedom. But I certainly didn't know you at Antioch. So you're in the right position to challenge anything I say.
I don't have any defense of Antioch. You know, I learned a lot there about a lot of things, but I smile about it because Horace Mann is certainly a very important figure in their history.
Okay.
What I think is amusing about this look-say method is that it is used to keep people deaf and mute today.
Yes.
Who were not born that way, but were made.
Yes. I've been horrified. You know, I used to teach University of California. I was horrified at graduate students who couldn't spell or write a simple sentence. I don't know how they ever got there. I mean, they were bright kids.
Well, the worst thing about young people who can't really read and write well is that they sense themselves inferior, mm-hmm. are intimidated, and do not seek jobs that require good communication and articulation, and that is exactly what the order wants
exactly.
to do.
Exactly.
Is to keep the bright people that come up out of the middle class from assuming those positions.
Exactly.
Now, I'd like you to go on and tell us what you think is the next most devastating accomplishment of the order in education, as you've exposed it in your book.
I think it was to bring the experimental psychology of Wundt in Germany. He was the first experimental psychologist. And his idea was that we're all the subjects of stimuli. You know, we get hit on the head, so we take moves not to get hit on the head again. Everything we do in life is brought about by external stimuli. And Hall recognized this. He started under Wundt in Germany and brought the Wundtian method to the United States. This is the basis of the experimental schools and education, that you can stimulate and prod a student to follow a certain road. I think it's the Wundtian psychology that is...
Well, it's the animal theory.
The animal theory, exactly.
And, of course, that excludes the concept of the interior self mm-hmm. and the process of education being the process yes. of the unfoldment of that inner self, yes. the meshing of the soul with the mind, with mm-hmm. the physical body, the development, the drawing back from the subconscious mm-hmm. of the accomplishments of previous embodiments, the talents of existence, and therefore education contributing to the ongoing evolution of the soul mm-hmm. who does not begin and end with a physical body.
But, of course, Wundt is essential for the Hegelian theory of the state. If you're going to be a cog in the state, you've got to see yourself as an animal and is subject to external stimuli. You can't see yourself as an individual with a soul that needs development.
Well, history has proven that no one, no power, and no system can ultimately control the person in whom the divine spark is still ignited and where that flame of freedom is. And so freedom transcends all of this attempt to control. Mm-hmm. The only way you can control anyone is to first make him into either an animal or a mm-hmm. mechanization man.
Mm-hmm. If I can interject a comment here, it's very interesting that I think the order recognizes this. Within their correspondence, I pick up complaints. The people are not responding as they expect to be. Expect them to respond. They're too individualistic, and they're worried. They are definitely worried. In fact, I have one letter from one member to another, in which he tells his friend to not give up, don't give up. And here we've got all people in the in the outside free world, as I call it, who worry that they're going to take us over. Look, they're the ones that are worried, not us.
We shouldn't be. Right?
Well, there's only a few of them. There's 200 million of us in the United States. There's only 500 of them or so right around today. I mean, we can remove them if we had the power.
Well, we do have the power.
Oh, at some point, yes, when people know.
People have the power mm-hmm. when they know they have it.
Yes, exactly. And this is why you have to keep these things secret. I mean, once they become open, the power to a great extent is gone. But the point I want to make is they are worried. They're worried because people don't accept what they want.
Tony, speaking of education, what are the controls, let's say, at Oxford and admissions to other major schools in this country and at the high school level, and how do they really control higher education worldwide?
Oxford is a very important link in a world pattern. Carol Quigley, who wrote Tragedy and Hope, used to be professor of international relations at Georgetown University, identified the British equivalent to the order, as known as the group. The group stems from Oxford University. And so what there is in England is a rather similar order, which has liaison with the order in the United States. That stems from Oxford. How they control admissions, I don't think they control admissions that closely. I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is twofold. One, at the doctorate level. You're not going to get a doctorate in any Western university if you argue against or produce evidence against the major direction of the order.
Is that really true?
I think that is true.
In any major Western university?
Any major Western university.
Today?
Yes. This is another story, but I've been quite surprised at the links, for example, between British universities and American universities at that level. Secondly, in the development of a career, you're not going to be hired in certain areas if you have strong views, which are against the requirements of the order. For example, you're not going to become a commentator on CBC if you're an outright exponent of individual rights. Now, I'm not saying that none of the existing commentators are members of the order, let me put it that way, but directors of the networks are. But one cannot say that any present commentator on television is an outright exponent of individual freedom. They're all tinged in a little way with this collectivist aspect. In publishing, you're not going, or as an author, you're certainly not going to make strong headway. I've identified so far a dozen publishing firms with members of the order, and it only takes one to turn down a book. So this is the problem you get. It's not at the acceptance level of the university, but when you get to the doctorate level or when you begin to develop your career. So my suggestion would be, if in your career you run into roadblocks, and if you're in a career that might possibly have some usefulness to the order, you better look at your own philosophy and see if it is collectivist enough or not. And if you want to make some headway in this world, you better become a collectivist. Of course, you might lose your own integrity along the way, but that's your decision and not mine.
Tony, the president had a task force on education, and they said that education had really declined, and it's really not important to look at the causes, it's important to look at the cures. We have to go ahead and improve education.
Well, I've got a simple answer to that. The report was useless, because what did it do? It just provided more money to do what has been done before. That was the same thing they did in the 50s. Remember when Sputnik went up in 1957? Oh, we've got a tremendous problem in mathematics and science. They poured billions into education. Didn't change the fundamental basis, which is to train you to be a cog in the state machine. So my solution would be quite a simple one. I'd just halve the funding.
Halve the funding.
Halve the funding. And if they didn't get their act together, to put it bluntly, and get a freedom, an educational system which would bring out innate talents, I'd halve it again. And just keep halving it until the educational people understood the function of education is to develop the individual, not to develop a state machine.
Now, they said that Japan and European nations and perhaps even second world nations were going to start to catch up and exceed the United States because of our failure of education. Now they're funding it, they're going to give it more money. Are you suggesting that that's an objective, to have the United States continue to decline in education so that other nations catch up? Or is that sort of an unfortunate consequence?
I would put it a little more broadly than that. There seems to be a pattern to have the general United States standard of living decline, and not only education, but in order to raise the rest of the world to the American standard of living, they're going to allow the American standard of living, or force it down, because the system here over 200 years has been too successful. And, of course, you can't take our successful system and apply it to underdeveloped countries, because, after all, what was the success based on? Individual initiative. And that's the last thing they want. So they've got a problem. You've got these statist and Marxist statist countries who are underdeveloped. You can't apply free enterprise, because then you've lost your statist control. You've somehow got to raise them, and the way to raise them is to take some from the United States and give it to them, and hope we'll all end up at the same level. So it's a broader thing than education. It applies to finance, it applies to economics and a number of things.
Well, they said in this report also that if a foreign power had done this to us, that we would consider it to be an act of war, that it had so seriously weakened the United States. Based on what you were saying earlier about the order sponsors war and revolution, if the order has carried this out and has been primarily responsible, would you consider this to be an act of revolution?
I think the order has been at war with the United States in general since 1833. There's no question about that. When you look at their individual actions.
And that is because if the flower of the United States, the flower of freedom, was to become what its potential was, their very elite positions would not have a stronghold.
Exactly. Exactly.
The greatest single threat to this breed that has antedated Christ is the nation that has itself founded upon a constitution that guarantees, absolutely guarantees, the rise of the individual.
This is one of the problems. They cannot live with the Bill of Rights. In fact, this is why when Archibald MacLeish, a member of the Order, wrote the Constitution for UNESCO, it was built into there that UNESCO would gradually try to erode press freedoms. In the Trilateral Commission, you'll find the same criticism, too much freedom of the press. There's just too much freedom for these people. They can't live with the Constitution. They tried to change the Constitution through the Fund for the Republic down here in Santa Barbara. They're not being successful yet, but they realize that there are roadblocks they've got to overcome to achieve what they want.
The most unfortunate thing to me is that when the people have coming at them from all directions this momentum of the order, they turn and espouse the order, or they let these people, or have in the past, become their idols, accept that they are an elite, accept that fact that they are superior, accept the projection from them to the people that they're superior.
Yes,
and today you will find people agreeing with the limitation of freedom. In various sectors of this country for
various
purposes.
I think that's a very unfortunate part of our society, that too many people are willing to abandon freedom for security, or what they see as security. You can get security in a Siberian gulag, but you can get freedom in Hitler's concentration camp. You know, but too many people are willing to give up freedom for security. Too many people are willing to look at these people as miniature gods. And because they have achieved power, don't ask how did they get power or what they're going to do with the power, but just the fact that they have power makes them a god and therefore they worship them. This to me is unbelievable. People, I put in one of my books, we've got 20, 30 million degree holders in the United States, people who've earned a college degree, but they don't question statements which are made by these people.
Well, it's an amazing thing that people, educated people, can accept that the interference with private property rights or with the press or public assembly or religion, free speech, the interference with that can somehow be necessary to the continuity of the republic or the security of the nation.
It's ridiculous. I can't answer for these people. All I hope is that they will examine their own consciences and their own minds.
Well, Tony, I think that in conclusion, it's very important that we understand how you develop in your third book, which is about to come out, the development of conflict to produce war or peace at their choosing, and how that has worked, let's say, in Vietnam or in the situations that are occurring today in the Middle East where there is great conflict. How is the order managing the conflict we see on the globe today?
Well, it's, as I mentioned before, basically it is using the Hegelian dialectic. You establish one side, then you establish the other side, then you bring them into conflict, then you manage that conflict. So you establish Soviet Union, you establish Hitler, you bring them into conflict, World War II. By managing the conflict, you can control the next decade or so. And as I mentioned, we built up the Soviet Union. We're building up Red China today, Communist China. We're even going to send the military technology. So by 1990-2000, we've established the two sides. We bring them into conflict.
Now tell me, why does Reagan go along with these agreements with Red China, which he just did, to supply this technology? He's not a member of the order. Why does he respond to its stimuli?
Because you've got a group within the administration who are members, who are connected with the order. When you get a group quite capable men working together, they can wear down opposition, they can erode opposition, because they're all kind of marching in step. If you get three men marching in step, they can do more than 20 men marching to their own step. Do I make my point here? And within the order, for example, within the administration, you've got, for example, Mr. Bush, and the people about Mr. Bush, Mr. Baker, chief of staff in the White House. And gradually you've seen the weeding out of those individuals who are independent. They've either resigned or they've moved out to other departments. So, in effect, the order has taken over very gradually, very carefully, without any fanfare.
How is the order then managing the conflict in the Middle East? It's hard to believe that the Arabs or the Iranians or the Iraqis are actually under anyone's control except their own.
I can't fully answer that today. Many of these questions you can only answer maybe 10 years later, when you can look at it in perspective. For example, I can look at Pearl Harbor today and see quite clearly a much different picture on Pearl Harbor than was put out in 1941. I can't look at the Middle East today and make too much sense, except you've obviously got two sides. You've got the Hegelian dialectic at work. You've got conflict being created, conflict being managed. The Marines go in, the Marines go out. Today, what, the Iraqis attacking the Iranian oil bases. You've got the deliberate two sides in these conflicts, the deliberate creation of conflict and the management of conflict.
Put it this way, is Castro in Cuba because the order wants him there?
Could I rephrase the question? Is Marxist Angola remaining a Marxist Angola because the order wants him? The answer there is yes, because I know in Angola, the Gulf Oil Company is the biggest supplier of foreign exchange to Marxist Angola. Pull Gulf Oil out of there, there's no more Marxist Angola. I can't answer as clearly for Cuba.
So Gulf Oil wants Marxism?
Oh, yes, it wants, undoubtedly.
And Marxism supports Gulf Oil?
Oh, yes. In fact, Cabinda, the Gulf Oil installation in Angola, is defended by Cuban troops. But you see, you've got an interesting phenomena.
Everyone should hear that one more time.
I said
Cabinda, <troops.
laughs> Cabinda, which is the Gulf Oil installation in Angola, Marxist Angola, is defended by Cuban troops.
So here we have Cuban troops defending a capitalist
monopoly. So-called capitalist. But one of the first things you learn in this business is forget about capitalism versus communism. That is absolute nonsense. The two are behind the scenes, are hand in hand.
It's a capitalist-communist conspiracy. One conspiracy.
Yes, but you need the so-called conflict between the two to keep people focusing. Look, they keep you looking over there, you know, capitalism versus communism. You know, that makes a nice little picture. You know, you get books on it and films on it, capitalism versus communism. That's not where the action is. The action is over here.
Well, what's the greatest single threat to the United States in terms of Central America, Nicaragua, El Salvador, the government of Mexico, that we need to be aware of in terms of an understanding that it is the order that is arranging things that are very detrimental to the future of this country?
Well, there you have a complex picture. Because it's not only a Marxist movement, it's also a rebellion against poverty, and there's bitter poverty down there, as we all know. You have to go across the border into Mexico to realize that. You have the intervention of certain religious groups, the Maronite Sisters, the Jesuits. There's another conflicting factor down there. You have, for example, in Panama, where the Panama Canal was handed back to Panama. There's a story behind that which involves the debts that Panama owed to the United States and the functions of Marine Midland Bank. And, of course, Sol Linowitz, director of Marine Midland, was a negotiator down there. You've got a very complex picture in Central America. What it is the creation of turmoil. Out of it, we will either get bogged down in another war or we'll get a series of Marxist states. But what we're heading into, I think, is an era where the order is willing to back some Marxist states but not others. It will back Marxist Angola. It tried to back Nicaragua for a while. It would not back Grenada. In other words, we're getting to a situation where there are good and bad Marxists.
So, in other words, the order made it possible for us to go into Grenada.
Oh, yes.
If they were backing the Soviets there, we couldn't have gone in.
Yes, because there were bad Marxists. Bad in quotes.
There were bad Marxists.
But you see, all this helps create conflict, helps perpetuate conflict. We never discuss what to me is elementary. All right, if these people are causing all the trouble in the world, we're not going to help them. We just cut off trade, we cut off technology, we cut off finance. Because the two key elements used to control these countries is debt and technology. So we'll cut off finance, we'll cut off technology. Marxism can't survive a decade without Western finance and Western technology. It'll crumble. But we won't do that. Why won't we do it? The only answer is we have to keep these systems going to create conflict.
So we mourn the shedding of blood of our Marines and their deaths when we ourselves are giving our blood and sweat every day of our lives to feed this international system.
Mm-hmm. International conflict system.
What do you think is the most important statement that you would like to give to the American people regarding the challenge they face in the order?
I think the challenge that they face affects not only their lives, but those of their children and their grandchildren. What can they do? I think first is understand what it's all about, to listen and to learn more. And then, as I've argued in one of my books, to develop their own individual plan. What role in their life, what are they going to do as individuals to thwart or to block in their own little way the purposes of the order, whereas it may be joining an organization like yours, or there, you know, maybe 1,000 different ways of doing it. So I think it's up to an individual to look at this and decide what he or she is going to do.
And also discover that there is strength in union and strength in numbers when tackling a Goliath of this proportion.
Yes, particularly I think psychological strength. I have no problems with acting alone, but I think most people do. I think most people prefer to have a what you might call a peer group that thinks and acts as they do, and they maybe feel stronger. That's never particularly worried me. I always get worried when I find a lot of people are thinking as I do. I feel there might be something wrong with me. But I know it does worry most people. And so joining a group would undoubtedly be a good thing to do.
Well, how effective do you feel you've been as the Paul Revere of the 20th century?
I don't see myself as a Paul. I see myself purely as a researcher doing a job.
You're publishing books that are giving information that is sounding an alarm that the order is coming.
Well, that was not my purpose. My purpose was quite simple. There's a problem. No one's looked at it this way. All the answers I see are wrong. Let's see if I can find an answer which fits the facts. That has been my motivation. I'm basically a researcher, problem solver.
So you've dissected a problem.
Yes.
But how have you solved the problem?
Well, I haven't solved it. All I've said, hey, there's the problem. I've really created problems. Because what have I done? You've had this nice, beautiful view of the world, and then I come along and say, hey, that doesn't look like that at all. If we take this, that's what's happening.
So you're an iconoclast.
I've created more problems than I've solved.
Well, sometimes the flame of freedom has to do that, to destruct,
yes,
tear down,
yes,
and then finally build.
Yes, you have to know what you're fighting. And that is fairly clear in my mind at this point.
So in your own way, you are a prophet to the nation, and you're saying if you don't take a look at this problem and do something about it, it may swallow you up.
Exactly. What springs to my mind for some odd reason is the Essenes. What was it? The forces of darkness and the forces of light. That's the root of the problem.
Well, Zarathustra defined it in the same way. Forces of good and evil.
Yes. That's what it comes down to. These people are evil. There's no question about that. None.
I was interested when you were talking about the conflict back in World War II. I wanted to know what assurances they had that Hitler would attack Stalin, since they had signed a non-aggression pact. And therefore, what assurances do they have that China and the Soviet Union will become embroiled,
yes,
in a conflict? Because at least in the Soviet Union, and I assume so also in China, they study history.
When they financed Hitler, one of the discussions was, what does this man, Heitler, they called him at that time, what does this man, Heitler, want? What will he do? And because there was some discussion about whether they should back the communists in Germany. And then the agreement was to back the National Socialists because they could be manipulated into a war of revenge. At first the target was France, and then later it became the Soviet Union. They have no guarantee. They can make mistakes, and they've made many mistakes. There's no guarantee that you'll get conflict in 1990-2000 between China and Russia. I mean, my argument is there's another way to look at this, that China and Peking and Moscow, the people are not stupid. I'd back a Russian planner any day of the week against a Yale graduate. I mean, I know the Russians. I mean, not that my books have been on Russia. They are very, very ingenious and capable men. The chances are that China and Russia will get together against the United States. That's what well could happen.
In other words, the best laid plans of the order...
Again, off to stray.
The best laid plans of the order...
can go astray and have gone astray. They have no guarantees.
Well, these kingpins who move nations on their chessboards may one day find out that they themselves wind up in the jaws.
They will, or their children. Avril Harriman at 92 is not worrying. But some of them are.
Well, it seems to be the perpetual fate of the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
They're creating a monster. And
well,
I don't think they realize it.
The Chinese will never be controlled by any Western minds. That is just a fact of the inscrutable East. Given power, they are probably the most clever of people on the planet. They only lack one thing, is power. And we are now giving it to them.
Financing and technology. I would agree with that. I think our plan, their plans, not ours. Their plans could go astray very easily.
Sure, because it's in the Soviets' interest and in Peking's interest to play the other two powers off against each other.
That's right.
So why should the order's plan succeed?
Sure. That's right.
Especially since, Antony, by that time, the Chinese and the Russians will know all about the order thanks to your books, and they will not be about to allow Wall Street or the power behind Wall Street to determine their fate.
I think they are aware of the power of the order. Who went to visit Andropov? It was Bush. It was Harriman. The U.S. ambassador never had a private audience with Andropov. They are aware. The thing is, how are they going to play on the awareness of the world public? Now this has become public. How are they going to use that? How can they manipulate that? And I think they could.
Well, their game is to tell us they're going to deliver us from our overlords.
Exactly.
From
our
gods.
So we better do it ourselves first before they do it for us. Because otherwise we'll be replacing one monster with another one.
Well, we have to identify ourselves as Americans and realize that they're enemies of the people both within and without this nation. I think that some of our people tend to consider those who are the betrayers of America as Americans, and therefore to be anti-American.
They don't think of themselves as Americans.
No, but our people, the common people think that the members of the order in this country or the power elite are Americans, and then they tend to become anti-American or anti the elite.
That's a great mistake.
It is.
Because they may historically have come from the Pilgrim Fathers, but they gave up being Americans 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Maybe they never were.
Well, maybe they never were. That's another story. Maybe they never were.
Tony, does the Order have a vested interest in the nuclear hysteria? And are they...
Oh, yes. They were there right from the start. The Manhattan Project, which was the United States project to develop the atom bomb. Stimson, a member of the Order, was Secretary of Defense. His two assistants in charge of the Manhattan Project were Harrison and McBundy. Three members of the Order started up the atomic project. When it came to target selection for dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, the Order came along and wiped out certain targets. They didn't want, for example, Kyoto bombed. They'd been there right from the start.
So,
and, of course, to bring your question up to date, it's very useful as a means of creating a fear in people.
Right. Are they interested, or are they worried themselves about a nuclear war, or do they try to exploit the fear of global
I think it's exploitation of the fear. I don't think they have any belief that one will come about.
Well, what do they look upon in their Soviet counterparts who are building underground bunkers, civil defense? Do they think this is a waste of time and money? Or?
Of course, you've got to look at it from the Soviet viewpoint. Why are the Soviets doing this? It's because they truly fear these people. You know, I'm about as anti-Soviet as you can get, but I'm not going to say that everything the Soviets think and do has no foundation. I think the Soviets really do believe that these people are a threat.
That the order is a threat? A threat to whom?
to their order. As a matter of fact, they have an order too. It's called the Brotherhood.
It's called the Brotherhood.
Yes, they have an order too within the Kremlin. That's why Chernyenko got the job, and not a much younger man. He's the last of the old members of the order. So you've got the Oxford situation, the group in England. You've got the order in the Soviet Union. You've got an order here.
Anywhere else?
Not that I've found so far. I'm interested what's behind all this. Because if you get, say, 500 members of the order today in the United States, there must be a smaller group. 500 don't get together and decide things. There must be a small inner group. I identify Avril Harriman undoubtedly as being the godfather, the chairman, but the others must be a dozen.
Who's the heir apparent to Avril Harriman?
I would say Bush. My guess is Bush. My guess. But I don't know.
And would you say that President Reagan does not know this?
He does now. But he didn't 2 months ago.
How do you know that he knows?
Well, because I understand my newsletter goes to the White House, so I guess somebody told him. I know they told Mr. Bush. So I don't know how they're discussing it. My spies haven't told me yet what they're saying amongst themselves, but I shall find out sooner or later what they're saying.
Tony, we'd like to thank you for being with us at Summit University Forum, where the flame of freedom speaks and where you have been its spokesman today. Thank you very much, and come back soon.
Thank you very much.